right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump is challenging special counsel Robert Mueller, accusing him of political bias in his investigation of Trump's possible 2016 election campaign links to Russia and whether the president obstructed justice in trying to hinder that probe. The president took to Twitter saying that Mueller had a team of Democrats who supported his rival Hillary Clinton, but no members of the president's own Republican Party. He also called out two former ousted FBI officials, former director James Comey, fired by Trump last May, and former deputy director Andrew McCabe, dismissed at Trump's urging late Friday by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, 26 hours before McCabe was set to retire and collect a full pension. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says the center of the Afrin region is entirely under the control of the Turkish and allied Syrian forces. The Reuters news agency reports a spokesman for the Turkish-backed Syrian rebel fighter said earlier the rebels had entered Afrin before dawn Sunday and that Kurdish YPG forces had withdrawn. As the dispute between Britain and Russia continues over the poisoning of a former Russian spy on British soil, the Kremlin expelled 23 British diplomats. Britain expelled 23 Russian diplomats last week. UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, speaking to BBC's Andrew Marr, dismisses several notions.
Listening again to the response of the Russian ambassador to the EU with his satirical suggestion that this was done by UK agents from Portendown. This is not the response of a country that really believes itself to be innocent.
Sergei Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, remain in serious condition. This is VOA News. Russians are voting today for a president in an election expected to give Vladimir Putin a win. Kyle Wilson is a former Australian diplomat to Russia.
I would have thought that what's probably very important for Mr. Putin is how many people turn out in Crimea. He will assume that Moscow won't vote for him because Moscow is one part of the country where, you know, he's failed to gain a majority before. And then, of course, he can say to the nation, look what the people of Crimea have said about me.
Mr. Putin faces opposition from several contenders, including Boris Nemtsov, who's dead, and Alexei Navalny, who's in jail. South Korean media saying a senior North Korean diplomat is now headed to Finland. That's to meet with former U.S. diplomats after a North Korean delegation wrapped up 3 days of talks with Swedish diplomats. All of this could lead to a possible meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Swedish U.N. Ambassador Olaf Skog.
The security situation on the peninsula is one of the most pressing issues on the world agenda right now. And if Sweden can play a part in de-escalation there, this is what we're trying to do.
President Trump has reaffirmed his plan to meet by the end of May with Mr. Kim to negotiate Pyongyang's nuclear program and hopefully get North Korea to be okay with ongoing U.S.-South Korean cooperation. Pakistan has conveyed to the leadership in Afghanistan its opinion that the Taliban are left with no excuse or justification for continuing war following Kabul's offer of unconditional peace talks. Islamabad's national security advisor delivered the message during a day-long official visit Saturday. We assured Afghan leaders of Pakistan's complete support for the long-awaited peace offer made by President Ashraf Ghani. The Taliban has not yet publicly responded to that offer. However, prompting expectations, the insurgents are weighing whether or not to come to the negotiating table. Pakistan and officials in the U.S. have both said. Police in the U.S. state of Florida do believe that they have recovered all of the bodies of the victims from the wreckage of a pedestrian bridge that collapsed last week over the busy highway. Five bodies were pulled from the wreckage Saturday alone. And again, South Korean media saying that the senior North Korean diplomat is headed to Finland to meet with the former U.S. diplomats after a North Korean delegation wrapped up 3 days of talks with Swedish diplomats. It is hopeful by some that it could lead to a possible meeting between U.S. President Donald Trump and a North Korean leader Kim Jong-un by May. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Mpuga.
If they all put their hands together, I think we can be able to get those who have taken them hostage. In the meantime, the security here is not going to sleep. While waiting for reinforcement from Harakati.
Armed separatists in Cameroon abduct 40 people, including a government official.
Our worry is the funding. With no resources in our hand, it's really difficult to support refugees where humanitarian needs are so immense.
Thousands of Central African refugees who fled southern Chad late last year to escape escalating violence are short of food, shelter, medical care, and other essential relief.
I think these girls, because they've come out with a message to say that this is who we are, there's a lot of stigma that has been attached to people who are living with albinism.
And Zimbabwe becomes the second country in Africa to host Miss Albinism Beauty Pageant after Kenya. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Armed separatists in Cameroon have abducted 40 people, including a government official. The abductions occurred as President Paul Biya dispatched a minister to the troubled English-speaking region on a peace-building mission. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon businessman Angelbert Etoga has returned to his hometown, Yaoundé, 24 hours after he was abducted and released by armed separatist groups. He says he and about 36 others were on a bus traveling to Lebealem in southwestern Cameroon to attend a political rally when armed men attacked and seized the vehicle. Etoga says they were detained for several hours and some were asked to leave after being told they had to respect the territorial integrity of the English-speaking regions of Cameroon, which the kidnappers said was now a state called Ambazonia.
Il est possible qu'il y ait des complicités au sein de la population, au sein des notables.
Etoga says it is very possible there is some cooperation among some of the population, traditional rulers and separatist groups. He says he is very certain that many people are adhering to separatist ideologies. Etoga says he does not know how many people were freed or held back, but he found his way out of the bush and returned to Yaoundé. The most senior government official in Lebealem, Zachary Ugito, says Professor Ivo Leke Tambo, a former Secretary General of Cameroon's Secondary Education Ministry and now chair of the Cameroon General Certificate of Education Board, was also abducted.
I call first and foremost the population of Lewo, the traditional rulers of Lewo, to in fact put in place whatever means to ensure that Professor Tambo will be safe. They should go out and look for him. He's a venerated elite of that village, and if they all put their hands together, I think we can be able to get those who have taken him hostage. In the meantime, the security here is not going to sleep while waiting for reinforcement from Haraki.
Ugito calls for the traditional rulers of Lewo to ensure Professor Tambo's safety and work to ensure his release. He said security measures would be increased in the meantime. In a video circulated by suspected armed separatists on social media, Tambo is seen stripped almost naked in the presence of disguised gunmen. Two other government officials were abducted last month and have not been found. The abductions took place the day the first English-speaking Cameroonian to be appointed Minister of Territorial Administration, Paul Atanganji, was visiting English-speaking towns in northwestern Cameroon in an effort to find solutions to the separatist crisis. Nji says President Biya is committed to win the war he declared against armed Anglophone separatists.
The head of state, His Excellency Paul Biya, Commander-in-Chief of Armed Forces, told me to tell all the forces of law and order that they can count on him, that he will give them all the resources which will permit them to accomplish their missions.
The crisis in the English-speaking regions of Cameroon began in late 2016 with English teachers and lawyers protesting what they called the overbearing use of French in the English-speaking zones of the bilingual country and degenerated with separatist calls for independence. The government says hundreds of people, including 30 policemen and soldiers, have died in violence since January when Nigeria detained and then extradited separatist leader Ayuktabe Julius and 46 other alleged separatists to Cameroon. The separatist groups are demanding the 47 detainees who have not been seen in public be released. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports thousands of Central African refugees who fled to southern Chad late last year to escape escalating violence are short of food, shelter, medical care, and other essential relief. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports fighting between armed groups in Northwest Central African Republic last December displaced some 65,000 people and prompted more than 22,000 others to flee to Chad in search of refuge. The agency finds this big refugee influx is adding an enormous burden on an area already hosting nearly 90,000 refugees and Chadian returnees from CAR. Southern Chad is considered one of Chad's poorest and most underdeveloped regions. UNHCR spokesman Babar Balosh says food shortages and rising prices are putting the lives of the refugees in host communities at risk.
Since last December, more than 15 Central African refugees have been killed on both sides of the border, and at least 67 have been subjected to sexual and gender-based violence while trying to go back to CAR to gather food and complement their scarce resources in exile.
UNHCR and partners have been providing protection, health care, water and sanitation, shelter, food and other basic relief to newly arriving refugees. But Balash tells VOA this is no longer possible because the money has run out.
Our worry is the funding. With no resources in our hand, it's really difficult to support refugees where humanitarian needs are so immense. Many refugees are living among the local villages. Many of the host communities are hosting them, but resources are needed to support both refugees as well the host communities.
Balar says UNHCR has received only 2% of the $149 million it urgently needs for this year's operation in Chad. He says severe flooding has badly affected this season's harvest, and food reserves are nearly exhausted. As a consequence, he says, many refugees and local residents are eating leaves and wild fruit, which often are toxic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization reports major breakthrough in efforts to contain South Africa's longest and largest listeria outbreak. Once again, Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The current outbreak of listeriosis in South Africa began more than 1 year ago in January 2017. As of March 12th, the World Health Organization has recorded 978 lab-confirmed cases of this foodborne disease, including 183 deaths. WHO food safety expert Peter Ben-Embarek says it is very difficult to investigate outbreaks of listeriosis because the disease has a very long incubation period. He says it can take several weeks before people show any symptoms, get sick, and are hospitalized.
2 weeks ago, food was identified as the primary source of this large outbreak. It's a meat, ready-to-eat meat product, the type of sausage very commonly consumed in South Africa and in the region, a bologna product. Since then, recall of the incriminated products have been initiated, both in South Africa but also in 15 countries that have imported these products from South Africa.
Mbarak says WHO is facilitating the exchange of information between South Africa and countries who have imported this contaminated product. He says it is important to recall the sausage and remove it from the shelves to prevent further cases from occurring. Now that the source of this foodborne disease has been identified, he tells VOA he expects the number of new cases to quickly drop.
With regard to the case fatality rate in this outbreak, among the cases where they have been able to follow them and see the outcome of their disease, it's about 27%, and it's within the norms. Listeriosis outbreak have a case fatality rate of between 20 to 30%. It's a very severe foodborne disease.
And Mbarak says listeriosis can be effectively treated with antibiotics if caught promptly, particularly in the case of high-risk populations such as newborn babies, pregnant women, and the elderly. He says WHO is not recommending any restrictions on travel or trade. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In a move aimed at boosting regional trade, Kenya and Uganda have commissioned a one-stop border crossing post, allowing goods to move quickly along the main trade corridor between the two East African nations. The new open crossing point in Busia will be jointly managed by the two countries to maximize efficiency. From the border town of Busia, Ruben Chama reports for VOA.
When Florence Atieno became a widow with six children to raise, many people in our community thought our children would drop out of school. But instead, Atieno started a business of selling cereals and household goods in Busia, a town on the Kenya-Uganda border. At first, life as a cross-border trader was hard and risky as she was vulnerable to exploitation. But in a joint effort to bolster trade relations, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and Ugandan leader Yoweri Museveni recently opened a one-stop border post. Atieno says it is a reason to celebrate.
Ni furaha kuu kwetu kwa sababu ni kitu imetufunua. Na imetufungua akili. Ingaje kuna wale wengine hawajajua maana hiyo kituo cha kufanya kazi kwa pamoja, maana yake ni nini vile iko hapo. Lakini wale watu wanafanya biashara kwa mpaka na wameelezwa umuhimu wake, tumejua faida yake kuu.
She says it was a great sigh of relief because it has opened doors to businesses. There are those who do not know the benefits of the one-stop post, but for cross-border traders, they know the huge benefits that they will come with the new arrangement. Atieno is among several women who normally cross the border into Uganda to buy maize, beans, and other merchandise, then return to sell in Kenya.
Sasa nyuma hapa imekuwa changamoto zaidi kwa sababu wakina mama hawakujua haki yao. Wanafanya biashara ndogo ndogo wakifuka mpaka wengi wao walikuwa wakina mama.
She says they used to have a lot of challenges. The women traders were exploited because they didn't know their rights. Atieno says most of the cross-border traders are women and many carry their children as they sell their goods. Atieno's story is not unusual. Crossing borders in many African countries can be costly and dangerous, especially for women. Most women have to pay bribes and fines and risk being robbed, attacked, and sexually assaulted. Ruth Warutere works with a regional civil society organization that promotes women traders across East Africa.
We have seen an increase in the number of women using formal routes as opposed to when they were using the informal routes. We have seen women increasing their volume and value of trade because now they know what they're supposed to do. They are not losing money on the panya routes. They are not wasting any money crossing with middlemen. We have also seen a gender-responsive trade environment being created at the border because generally we engage with border officials, tell them that these are the issues that are affecting women traders. This is what needs to be done. And so we have seen now the border officials becoming more friendly to the women. They invite them to the JBCs. The JBCs are the Joint Border Management Committees, which bring together border officials from each side of the border to discuss the issues at the border.
Busia is one of Eastern and Central Africa's busiest border points. The new one-stop crossing means that people can exit one country and enter another without having to move to different buildings or get in extra lines. It's expected to cut crossing times, which can stretch hours by a third or more. Addressing the crowd at the official inauguration a few weeks ago, Kenya's President Kenyatta praised Trademark East Africa, British-funded organization that is at the forefront of promoting regional trade and integration among East African states.
Trademark East Africa has been a practical partner in trying to ease trade in our region, all the way from developments in the port of Mombasa, helping us with our customs, all to facilitate trade between the peoples of East Africa and to make it easier and less costly for our people to trade with one another and to make our people move forward together.
The Busia one-stop post has added entry and exit points already operating in the region. It handles transit traffic to and from the Great Lakes region of Uganda, Kenya, Rwanda, Burundi, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and South Sudan. For VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Busia on the Kenya-Uganda border.
In South Africa, the government is demanding an apology from Australia's Home Affairs Minister. Earlier last week, Minister Peter Dutton said his government was considering fast-tracking the visa application of white South Africans because they are at risk in their home country. The comments have angered South African officials who say Dutton is causing unnecessary panic. Now Pretoria has issued a demand, essentially a diplomatic objection, saying Dutton must retract his words. From Johannesburg, for VOA, Nadia Samia has their story.
The South African government has been reiterating its commitment to land redistribution without compensation. The governing ANC party recently voted in favour of the opposition Economic Freedom Fighters motion in Parliament to expropriate land. President Cyril Ramaphosa hasn't explained how he'll do this, but insists it will be a lawful process. Since that vote, there have been several attempts to illegally occupy land. It prompted Australian Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton to remark that white South African farmers should be prioritised for visas as they face violent land grabs. Afrikaans lobby group AfriForum says it hopes this will prompt Ramaphosa's government to act on the safety concerns it's raised.
We actually feel that the South African government should see this as a wake-up call or as a charge against them, because the Australian Minister of Home Affairs obviously takes issues like the farm attack and farm murder and also the whole issue of expropriation without compensation in a serious light. While if we voice concerns about this in South Africa, then the government usually just shrugs it off.
According to AfriForum's figures, farm attacks and murders have increased every year from 2011 to 2016. Figures for 2016 show there were 334 attacks and 64 murders on farms. Most occurred in Gauteng, the country's wealthiest province. The statistics for 2017 are still being finalized. Alana explains why farmers are particularly vulnerable.
Because of the isolation, I think you're more exposed to violence over a longer term than with a normal house attack in South Africa. If you're in a suburb, then people can hear you, they can come to your aid much faster. What we hear from people is that if they have been a victim of such an attack in the past, they're concerned that the people will return.
The South African government says white farmers are at no greater risk than black farmers and the issue should not be racialized. It's angry about the comments from Australia. International Relations Minister Lindiwe Sisulu summoned the Australian High Commissioner to her offices on Thursday.
We have indicated to them that we are offended and we expect a retraction, and I think we must give that government an opportunity to respond.
Mabaya says Dutton's comments are stoking racial divisions in South Africa.
White farmers and black farmers are all treated equally. So when we look at farmers in South Africa, we don't look at them across colour lines. We look at them as farmers.
The Australian High Commissioner has promised to immediately relay Minister Sisulu's message to his government. The South African International Relations Department says it has several diplomatic options should Dutton refuse to apologise and retract his utterances. For VOA Africa, I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe has become the second country in Africa to host Miss Albinism Beauty Pageant. The first was Kenya. This initiative comes against a backdrop of discrimination and stigma towards people with albinism. In other countries in Africa, there are harmful superstitions that have at times led to the killing of people with albinism. For VOA reporter Kuzai Vinavashi was at the debut event.
The pageant is the brainchild of Brenda Mutsimu, who has lived with albinism and relates to the stigma attached to people living with albinism. She is the director of Miss Albinism Trust. Together with the Zimbabwe Albino Association and Leonard Cheshire Organization, hosted Miss Albinism Zimbabwe on Friday evening in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. Mutsimu explains the idea behind the event.
The idea of doing this pageant is to raise awareness for people living with albinism, is to instill confidence within the albinism community, and again, to avoid social factors that may lead to stress and low self-esteem.
The pageant will be hosted annually going forward. Its organizers say the idea goes beyond advocating for people with albinism alone, but for people living with disabilities. Although the event did not start on time, the attendance was fair, and at the end of the evening, one tertiary student who was a contestant, Sitembiso Mutukura, was crowned Miss Albinism Zimbabwe. She was ecstatic about winning and touched on some challenges people with albinism face.
I'm very excited. Beyond the description of words, very happy. We are celebrating the beauty of albinism. I'm very excited. Persons with disabilities are always looked down upon. If the Zimbabwean government really wants, it can change the situation of persons with disabilities. If you find that even if you graduated, when you're a person with disability, when you graduate there, you'd spend something like 5, 6, 7 years without being employed.
Former Miss Zimbabwe and Miss Malaika, Brita Masale Tulini, was one of the judges of the inaugural pageant.
I think these girls, because they've come out with a message to say that this is who we are, there's a lot of stigma that has been attached to people who are living with albinism. And sadly, we've not responded in the way that we should be responding. But when something like this happens, it kind of draws the necessary attention. And it gets people who are maybe policymakers, get to sit up and pay attention.
She adds that such an initiative has the power to reach the ordinary men and positively impact them in changing their views towards people with albinism. The newly crowned Miss Albinism Zimbabwe says there is need for policy that proactively caters for people living with albinism and other disabilities. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African music mix on The Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African music mix plays only the best. Yes, sir. Two-Face. NATO C.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. And still to come in the program, sports and music from our African collection for your listening pleasure and relaxation. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And in sports, a video assistant referees, VARs, will be used at the World Cup for the first time in this year's finals in Russia, FIFA President Gianni Infantino said on Friday, and teams will be allowed a fourth substitute in matches that go to extra time. The use of the VAR system was approved earlier this month by the rulemaking body, IFAB, despite controversy in some of the competitions in which it has been tried over the time taken to make decisions and lack of information for spectators. Meanwhile, Tunisia are still ranked the best team in Africa by FIFA, who named their monthly rankings on Thursday. The Carthage Eagles, African champions in 2004, have been top since dethroning Senegal in January. Burkina Faso were the biggest movers by points in the whole rankings, as the West Africans gained 21 points. Africa's five World Cup teams, Egypt, Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal, and Tunisia, are ranked among the top seven sides on the continent. Elsewhere, Cairo Giants and multiple African champions Al Ahly have secured their 40th Egyptian League title. Hossam El Badri's team were confirmed as winners on Monday when a goalless draw between Al Masri and Etang Al Habe gave them an unassailable lead. The coach issued a rallying call for his squad to move on to their next target for 2018. He said in his words, "Our main objective now is to win the Egyptian Cup and the African Champions League after we lost the final last year." Al Ahly were beaten in the final of the continental competition by Moroccan giants Wydad Casablanca. Finally, in tennis, world number one Roger Federer made his best start to a season and reached the BNP Paribas Open final with a hard-fought win over Croatia's Borna Koric. The Swiss beat 49th ranked Koric 5-7, 6-4, 6-4 at Indian Wells. The win was Federer's 17th of the year, surpassing his previous career best of 16 consecutive victories in 2006. He will now face Argentina's Juan Martín del Potro in the final after the sixth seed's emphatic 6-2, 6-3 win over Canada's Milos Raonic. Also, Japan's Naomi Osaka made short work of a subdued world number one Simona Halep on Friday. The unseeded 20-year-old racing to a 6-3, 6-0 semifinal victory set up a surprise PNP Paribas Open final against Daria Kasatskina. The Russian, also 20, continued her sparkling run of form earlier in the evening when she outclassed American veteran Venus Williams in a three-set slugfest lasting almost 3 hours. Osaka's defeat of the top-seeded Halep stood out as the bigger of the two upsets, which played out under the lights on a chilly night in the California desert city of Indian Wells. While Osaka barely broke a sweat in her 64-minute victory, it was a different story for Kasatkina, who emerged the victor after a marathon 4-6-6-4-7-5 battle against Williams. Kasatkina took advantage of a subpar serving night from the more powerful Williams as the match progressed, forcing long rallies that ultimately wore her 37-year-old opponent down over the course of the contest. The win extends the Cinderella run for the tournament's 20th seed, who defeated Grand Slam champions Sloane Stephens, Caroline Wozniacki, and Angelique Kerber without dropping the sweat before going the distance to take down Williams. Kasatkina will face Osaka for the first time in their fledgling careers later on Sunday. And that's it from Nightline Africa Sports. Yes, and now it's time for our Sunday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great African music. Here we go. Mwendo na jeko, yote mwanana, misuruari ya nidondoka, tukimbiza nini sarume wangu,
Iyo michezo ya jogo Unawatiza machini sarome wangu Ukimuona jongo Inama kidogo Shika magoti Minimesimama kama ngongoti Mtoto jojo Sio robot Chumbani pingiri pingiri samba zote
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga sarome
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga kweri
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga
Orera bakuru
Utamkolea aprokoto Tingali tingali nani kwa moto Utamiongea msokoto Temesu mukali kama koboko
Mapenzi ananipa shida Shida mama Midonda lisokuwa na tiba Tiba bwana
Usije baby kanicharanga Kanichambua moyo kakaranga Mi baby kwenye msambwanda Wasinga jingenge ninganganga
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga sarume
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga kweri
Unante kinyaga ukinyonga
Orera bakuru vanyo Orera ngambe Orera nazariwa Orera ngambe
Mwenza konya nganyanga Zari wino nyanya
Baby kwa mwa Misimamie kama kanga Ibane kangwaru Babu yuma mpige kwa kwaru
Kwa kwaru kwa
Asa chambua kama karanga sasa
Chambua kama karanga
Ichambue kama karanga sarope
Chambua kama karanga
Asa washa Washa Mutu washa Washa Songa Songa Ugali songa Songa, bagaji, aji, bagaji, aji.
Wenye wivu wajinyonge leo,
wenye wivu wajinyonge.
Oh, wenye wivu wajinyonge sana,
wenye wivu wajinyonge.
Wenye wivu wajinyonge kweli,
wenye wivu wajinyonge.
Oh, wenye wivu wajinyonge sana,
wenye wivu wajinyonge.
Wanakodoa kodo, wanakodoa
macho kodo.
Wanakodoa.
Sitaweza, Nipe changu na mimi nikupe chako, kama unipendi hilo ni pako. We got a lot of issues to say to, pamoja twende mseto. Love me baby, I will love you back. Scratch my back, I will scratch your back. Not this way, unapenda upendi. Unaniumiza sana, ninateseka, nani moyoni mimi nauma.
I got to go,
kanende,
I let you go,
sitaweza.
Yes, that was our Sunday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Now, let's take a closer look at Africa, One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Take it away, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Last week, South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma, became the first African head of state to face prosecution for corruption after leaving office. The chief prosecutor of South Africa announced that former President Jacob Zuma would face prosecution for 16 charges of corruption relating to a multi-billion dollar arms deal. The charges relate more to arms deal with a French company going back to the 1990s. Former President Zuma had in the past denied all charges. It has long been suspected that many Africans would like nothing better than to see their former heads of state move from the state houses to the jail houses. And it is also based on the principle that no man is above the law, and that if African presidents have been guilty of corruption, they're to be subject to prosecution. But until last week, no former head of state had been faced with this dilemma. The issue then for South Africa goes beyond the prosecution of Jacob Zuma. The question is, based on their own tradition and history, many of you may recall that during the protracted and difficult negotiations that led to the end of apartheid in South Africa, the issue of impunity was discussed. Anti-apartheid forces wanted to prosecute apartheid leaders for crimes they may have committed during the apartheid period. But it was soon recognized that while this may give pleasure to many, it may cause problems initially for a black majority government. It is in these circumstances that they came out with the plan known as Truth and Reconciliation, which made it possible for those who may have committed crimes to come forward and admit their problem, they admit their crimes, and then they will get reconciliation forgiven. But that those who may fail to do that and found out later could be prosecuted. So it is very strange that in the case of President Zuma, it is one opposition political party in particular, the Democratic Alliance, that are being relentless in the pursuit of prosecution against Jacob Zuma. It should be recalled that when the initial charges were dropped in the 90s, before Jacob Zuma became president in 2009, it was the opposition that created cause problems, and again it was the opposition Democratic Alliance during the toxic period in the contest for the new presidency of the ANC that went to court and sought to revise the charges against Jacob Zuma. The Supreme Court granted that wish, and now the chief prosecutor will proceed. But it is also the Democratic Alliance that is prepared to go to court to challenge the new president, President Ramaphosa, for an arrangement that would allow the government to pay the cost of the trial of Jacob Zuma on the grounds that these charges relate to the time he was in government. Lastly, it is the leader of the Democratic Alliance that has publicly stated that he would be delighted to see former President Jacob Zuma in the orange suits of South African prisoners. In mature democracy, these things are not allowed. During the campaign in the United States for the presidency, the campaign of the president decided, went on a chant, and that chant of Donald Trump was "Lock her up." Many Americans have frowned upon that as not befitting a democratic society. Nothing has been heard yet from Jacob Zuma about this new charge, but it will proceed. And in many parts of Africa, we have had cases of presidents who have left office, like in Angola, where there have been calls for the prosecution of President Santos. And in fact, his children have been moved from lucrative positions in the country. People believe that one of the reasons why Africans' heads of state are reluctant to leave office is the fear of prosecution after they have left office. Now the question that we should ask in South Africa, yes, you are going to get the prosecution of Jacob Zuma. Today, the shoe is on his foot. Who could foretell what the future holds when the shoe is another's foot? And when you begin to have prosecution here and there based on purely political consideration, this is a dangerous path to tread. I thank you.
That was One Man Points of View, as commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Said Hamdun, and our engineer for tonight, Nick Ivanov, we thank you for joining us. I'm Douglas Impuga, wishing you a great week.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late December of last year, the Trump administration unveiled its national security strategy. One of the priority actions to be undertaken by the United States as part of this new plan is the advancement and protection of religious freedom and religious minorities around the globe. Vice President Pence, in his remarks at the World Summit in Defense of Persecuted Christians, said, "Protecting and promoting religious freedom is a foreign policy priority of the Trump administration." Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, Samuel Brownback, also said, "Religious freedom is the most important foreign topic today," in his remarks at the United States Institute of Peace. If there's one common thread that connects repressive regimes the world over, it is their oppression of minority religious groups. Persecution, repression, and discrimination are a daily reality for members of religious minority communities in too many countries around the world. Believers and non-believers alike are targeted for violence. Their human rights are limited or sometimes entirely restricted. The United States' response to such violations and abuses of religious freedom is based on the 20-year-old International Religious Freedom Act, which introduced the promotion and protection of religious freedom as a foreign policy priority for the United States. Over the past several years, the State Department has provided strategic guidance to its embassies and consulates about how to consistently advocate for rights of members of minority communities and promote their equal treatment in society. Recognizing the importance of preserving cultural heritage, the State Department has developed a partnership with the Smithsonian Institution to train church and other leaders of minority faith communities on how to protect ancient places of cultural significance. The department has also worked with the Organization of American States to recruit countries in our hemisphere to join these efforts to combat persecution in other regions. Nonetheless, there are increasing numbers of actors who continue to attack members of religious minority groups and undermine religious diversity. In response, we must stay committed to emphasizing the universal importance of this fundamental freedom. We can achieve lasting results by building and protecting environments where everyone can enjoy freedom of religion or belief.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.